Hello, I'm Jim Mallard, host of The Mallard Report. On The Mallard Report, along with my guest, we will have a conversation where we will share thoughts and opinions. For more information, my bio, past shows, social media links, and so much more, visit mallard.com. MALLIARD.com. And thanks for listening. Must apologize. The alarm that I set for 9 a.m. just went off now, which makes it 9 p.m., which is great. One of those days. Okay, anyways, my go over to Verity's Apparel / Mallard, save 10% for U.S. shipping, 10% off, made in America, good t-shirts. I'm wearing one now. I'm wearing the one that has Bigfoot and says believe in something bigger than yourself. So, anyways, Verity's Apparel / Mallard, save 10%. I think I got all that figured out squarely. My guest tonight is Fred Whitland, the author of I Was an American Teenager, JFK Conspiracy Freak. But first, before we get into the book, Fred, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm pretty good. How are you?
Pretty good. So, I think I heard you were 6 or 7 when the assassination happened?
Yeah, I was 7 years old and living in Montreal, Canada.
And did you, I mean, obviously the world changed. I mean, just tell me about how things were, like, that day and the days following.
Well, you know, I don't remember that much being 7. I remember just, I think we were let out of school early and walking home and feeling very sad, but I really didn't know very much about what had happened or what was going on. I was just a bit too young for it all.
But you knew something was up.
I knew something was up. I knew the president had been killed, but that's about all I really knew.
So fast forward, you said teenage, so fast forward 10 years or so?
Fast forward to 1975. March 1975, when I was watching Good Night America, the Geraldo Rivera show, and he played the Zapruder film for the first time. And that's what got me into researching the JFK assassination.
So it took 8 years to get that film out?
Yeah, well, Life magazine owned it, and part of the agreement with the Zapruder family was not to exploit the horrific nature of the film, and so they decided not to show it publicly.
This seems, I mean, I'm a kid of the 90s and now, and
yeah.
I mean, we all sat around the other day watching the cathedral burn, and now we're talking about just amazing the how technology has changed everything.
Oh yeah, it's a different era in many ways.
So take me back to the first time you've seen that film. What caught your attention about it?
Well, I was 18 years old. I'm watching this film on TV, and it really seemed frame 313 had Kennedy's head goes back and to the left. It seemed to me like a shot came from the front. But what I was really interested in was I wanted to know, okay, if it's so obvious that he was shot from the front, why did the Warren Commission say differently? And that's what really got into me. I had to find that out. What was the reason? There must be a counter explanation. And so I went off to the library, and the first book I read was Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment. There were very few books on the shelves in our library, but I did read Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment.
Tell me a little bit more about that, because I have not picked that one up yet.
Well, Mark Lane was a ambulance chaser, and he had decided after the assassination to go down to Dallas, and perhaps this would be a meal ticket for him. He was completely correct. It was a meal ticket. He stirred up the pot of conspiracy, ultimately writing Rush to Judgment in 1966. It's a horrible book, full of omissions and errors and misstatements, and a really dreadful book, but it sold over 1 million copies and made him a lot of money.
Do you believe that's a lot where the origin point of a lot of these conspiracies was or is?
He was the early one who was really out there pushing conspiracy. There were a number of other people. Obviously, a whole host of books came out in 1965 and 66, mostly in 66. His was the big one, the one that really sold. And he toured all over the states and every college campus you could think of. So he was really out there.
So after you read that, and where'd you? I mean, because obviously I'm sitting here thinking you went to the library to get this. See, again, here's the
difference in
the gaps.
Yeah, I went to the library, and what was interesting in the book, it was written in 1966, and in the book he talked about the JFK autopsy X-rays and photos. And in his book, he said they had been confiscated by federal police agents. So I wanted to know more. And so I went to the periodical index and the New York Times in a yearly index to see, because his book was written in 66. It's now 1975. So I had 9 years to catch up. And I found out that in 1972, two doctors were allowed to examine the JFK autopsy X-rays and photographs. And I got their names. I went to a directory of physicians in the U.S., got their addresses. I wrote them both letters. That was Dr. John Latimer and Dr. Cyril Wecht. And about 10 days later, I got a big, thick package from both doctors with all of their articles. And that cleared up a lot of stuff about the headshot, because the autopsy X-rays and photos are clear that Kennedy was shot from behind, not from the front.
They both agreed on that.
They both agreed, and it was clear that it was a neuromuscular spasm that had caused Kennedy's head to go back. So that was one mystery solved.
So what other? So at that point, you're all on board with, is that the cleaning up your conspiracy thoughts, or is that?
I was really, I was very intrigued with Dr. Cyril Wecht and the fact that he was a very big critic of the single bullet theory, the theory that one bullet went through JFK and Governor John Connally, causing 7 wounds and coming out relatively unscathed. I thought that didn't make much sense, and so I thought there was something there. And basically, school interrupted in 1980. When 1978, I went off to MBA school and Queen's University at Kingston, and I put all my JFK stuff aside. And that was right at the era of when the House Select Committee on Assassinations had finished their second investigation and had issued their report saying that there was probably a conspiracy.
Probably. That's an interesting word.
Yeah.
I mean,
they couldn't find it. But I wanted to know more because their conclusions mirrored the Warren Commission. The House Select Committee on Assassinations said that Oswald fired 3 shots. 2 of his shots hit Kennedy. 1 killed Kennedy. The same, and they even supported the single bullet theory. So I thought all that was very interesting. They did believe that there was 1 shot fired from the front that missed. And that was because of the acoustics evidence. Of course, we all know that was overturned by the National Academy of Sciences a few years later.
What an interesting... Because with all the resources the government has, you'd think they'd be able to produce a product that's definitive one way or the other. Not just, maybe, possibly, could have...
Well, they were about to issue a very definitive report, and then at the last minute, the Dictabelt evidence came up, and they hired Bold, Baranek, and Newman, and Ashkenazi, Weiss, and Ashkenazi to examine them, and they both came back and said that the acoustics evidence pointed to a second gunman, and that forced the House Select Committee to change their conclusions at the last minute. Of course, both of those firms were in error about the acoustics evidence. The acoustics evidence did not capture the assassination.
Take me back, because I'm unfamiliar. That's based off the recordings that were available, and
the theory was that the motorcycles, the police logs, were captured on something called a Dictabelt. It's a magnetic sort of tape recorder with a belt that records all police transmissions. The theory was that perhaps one of the motorcycles in the motorcade, maybe its microphone had jammed. And if it had jammed and stayed open during the assassination, the Dictabelt might have recorded the shots. And so at the last minute, the House Select Committee on Assassinations sent the dicta belt to both Beranek and Newman, and they examined it, and they felt that they had found at least four shots, one of which came from the grassy knoll, and that put the committee in a bind, because they were ready to conclude that there was no conspiracy. And so they went to Jim Barger, the lead scientist. They said, "Are you ready to testify nationwide that there was a second gunman?" And he started to hedge his bets, and he eventually testified that there was a 50% chance of a shot from the knoll. Then they went to a second firm, Weiss and Ashkenazi, two guys in Queens, from Queens in New York, and they did some more tests, and they came back and said there was a 95% chance of a shot from the front. So that forced the Select Committee to change all their conclusions. Of course, 2 years later, the National Academy of Sciences re-looked at the acoustic evidence and conclusively determined that, in fact, it did not capture the shots at all. And so there goes the evidence of a conspiracy.
Again. Another part that... I've never understood the grassy knoll. But that's just...
Yeah.
Is that... Okay, You've been doing you did your first presentation on JFK in what, 1994, and you've been researching it for.
Well, I've been researching 1975, but I gave a presentation in Liverpool, England, on the JFK assassination. That was my first public presentation.
So okay, so you've been after this for a while. So what is the one? I mean, I know most of the conspiracy things just drive you absolutely, I'll say it, batshit crazy.
Yeah.
But what's the one that all just instantly breaks you and makes you just want to boil over?
Well, the worst one is the whole Clay Shaw affair. Clay Shaw was this gay businessman in 1967 who was charged with conspiring to kill Kennedy by New Orleans prosecutor Jim Garrison. It was a complete sham of a case. It took 2 years to go to trial. Shaw was acquitted. Then he was charged with perjury, which took another couple of years, bankrupted him, and then he died of cancer. Very sad story. And then Oliver Stone decided to make his movie, and he made Clay Shaw the villain in his movie, and he made Jim Garrison the hero, completely reversing their true roles. That drives me crazy.
Wait. If Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, how was there a conspirator?
Well, Jim Garrison was this prosecutor. Lee Harvey Oswald lived in New Orleans in the summer of 1963. And so back when the Warren Commission was investigating, there were a few leads. I mean, before the Warren Commission, there were a few leads in New Orleans that Jim Garrison investigated in December of 1963. It didn't lead to anything. But back when the controversy of the Warren Report started in 66, he decided he would go back to those old leads and see if maybe they would lead somewhere. And ultimately, through some very bad reasoning, he started to believe that this gay businessman, Clay Shaw, was a conspirator in the assassination. It's an incredible story. It's all in my book. And I also tell the story of Oliver Stone's JFK. It's an incredible scandal.
So let's do this since we're right here, since you just mentioned the book. Give people the clean promo where they could find the book and your website and all that stuff before we get on.
My website is conspiracyfreak.com, and you could find my book on Amazon, on iTunes, on Kobo, Kindle. Anywhere you can buy a book online, you will find my book, I Was a Teenage JFK Conspiracy Freak.
Okay, so... The act of Jack Ruby was totally coincidental then?
Yes, Jack Ruby is a very interesting story, and a lot of people don't really know the true story. Jack Ruby, on the day of the assassination, that morning, there was an ad, a full-page ad in the Dallas Morning News, accusing Kennedy of all sorts of crimes. It was a right-wing group that had taken a full-page ad out. At the bottom of the ad, it was signed Bernard Weissman. Jack Ruby saw that ad on Friday morning before the assassination, And he was quite upset because Bernard Weissman is a Jewish name. And he was wondering, you know, what's going on with this ad? After the assassination, he was wondering, were Jews behind the assassination? Was this guy Weissman involved? On the ad was a post office box, and Jack Ruby actually went to the post office box to see if he could find out who this guy Weissman was. Of course, they wouldn't tell him, but he did see there was a lot of mail in the post office box. But it enraged him. It enraged him that maybe Jews, he was Jewish, he was enraged that Jews might be involved in the assassination. It sort of made him a bit go crazy. And on Sunday, he killed Oswald. The whole thing completely backfired on Ruby because the John Birch Society, which is a far right-wing organization, started accusing him of being involved in the conspiracy. They would only call him by his real name, Jacob Rubenstein, because they liked to go after Jews. And so Jack Ruby went really mental, and he started to believe that there was going to be a second Holocaust, and that people would blame him, representative of the Jews, for killing Kennedy. It's an incredible story.
It is. I mean, I guess, you know, you hear some of these things, and you file them away, and then you bring them back up, and you go, oh, yeah, I did know that, but it's just...
What's interesting, you know, for a while after when Jack Ruby first was in jail right after killing Oswald, he got a lot of cards and letters from people congratulating him on what he had done. He thought he was going to get out in a few years of jail and be a little bit of a celebrity. And he was completely mistaken.
I can't imagine that thought process, but I can't imagine most of these thought processes, so here we are. Do you have any, I mean, the autopsy photos and that stuff going with the Kennedy family, do you have any qualms with that, or is that okay with you?
It's everybody should go and read the authentication reports of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. They took the photos and the x-rays, and they gave them to forensic dentists, they gave them to anthropologists, they gave them to photo experts. They did every possible scientific test on the autopsy x-rays and photos to see if they were legitimate, and they were. They passed every single test. We know that the man in the picture, in those autopsy pictures, was JFK. We know, there's no mystery. It's all really, you know, everybody should go read the authentication reports. They're quite conclusive. So I have no qualms about them.
Well, that's the key, though. I mean, That seems to be a spark of conspiracy, too, because they rushed him out of Dallas to get the autopsy done, and, you know, that's another point of the conspiracy world that
of course,
people point to.
You do know that the coroner of Dallas, Dr. Earl Rose, was on the forensic pathology panel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations.
Yeah, I do remember. See?
And he concurred with...
This mind's going to get going here in a few seconds, I promise.
Yeah, so he concurred with, so at least he got his crack at looking at all the autopsy materials later on. Look, the law was that the autopsy should have been done in Dallas, but I can understand why the Secret Service would want to get the body out of Texas into Washington. Sort of makes a little bit of sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, you can go both ways with that, though. But I understand it. But I can. There's a case to be made for letting them do what their needs done. But so you mentioned some. I'm going to shift gears out of this for a few minutes while I circle around them.
Okay.
You are an interesting guy beyond JFK.
Yep, I think so.
Is that a fair statement?
I think so.
Besides writing the book, you've dabbled in. I don't want to say dabbled. Sounds like dark magic. That's not appropriate. You're knowledgeable. You've performed things with music and films and tech.
Yep. I own a company called Northern Blues Music, which is a blues music label. Started that in late 2000. We've come out with around 70 CDs of various American and Canadian artists. And so that's been a real joy in my life the last 19 years, although the music industry right now is not doing very well. I started the Freethinking Film Society in Ottawa, which is a not-for-profit film society that shows documentaries on liberty, freedom, and democracy. So we've shown over 100 films in Ottawa. We did 4 film festivals. And I've written 2 books.
So we're going to go back through this because that was way too much information, way too fast.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you mentioned the music industry being in the crapper.
Yeah.
I don't think you said crapper, but I will. Is there any changing that? I mean, or are we just kind of stuck in this mess?
No, nothing is going to change. I think we're in a very... It's actually quite funny because the cost of making professional music has come way down. I mean, individuals could make really terrific sounding music right now at a very, very low price in their own homes. So the price of making music has come way down, but the industry's gone away because the Spotify now, music is becoming more and more free or less and less expensive, and so the money is being taken out of the industry. It's being sucked out of the industry, and that's not going to come back. So ironically, it's cheaper now than ever to make music, so there's more music than ever before. There's just not an industry that really surrounds it.
So now for the tough question, the hardest question of the night probably, is music better now than it was when you were a kid?
Well, my taste, I'm a roots guy. I like country, I like early rock, I like blues, I like jazz. I think music is better in the sense that there's more talented musicians now than ever before. I mean, people who could really play amazing stuff. So now, people just get better. So I think in that sense, the music is better. The quality of the recordings is better than it was back then. I mean, I remember how awful it was to buy albums and have them scratch and tick and pop and hiss, and I used to hate it. So it's a much better experience now for music than ever before. So I think things have gotten better in that sense.
But she's...
It's just...
But I'm thinking of the last time I walked around the store and there's vinyl on the shelf.
Yep.
People were buying it.
Well, they're not buying that much vinyl.
No, but I mean, even to have it come be remade just seems stupid to me.
It's very few stores can even sell vinyl because of the shelf, the way it has to be shelved. So if you look at the numbers, it's growing, but it's a very small number of units. Vinyl will never become huge again. So it's sort of a little bit of a curiosity right now, but it's not going to really go anywhere. Spotify is what's really affecting music right now, and the fact that artists and record labels just aren't getting paid by having their music on Spotify.
How is that legal, though? Shouldn't they have to pay?
Well, they're paying a very small rate. So, everybody's going to sign up because that's the game in town, or it's as well as Apple Music. But you're getting very, very little money. And so the money is being sucked out as more and more people go to these monthly service plans. And if Apple ever closes iTunes, that'll be the real death of all the record labels.
So how it's live shows now is how musicians are going to make their living?
Yeah, it's going to be live shows, and of course, it's not an easy life to play live. I mean, look, for the top artists, they can do okay. But for middle-tier, lower-tier artists, it's a very, very tough life because, going on the road is hard. I mean, I look at the way blues bands, if you look at blues bands, they go across the country. I mean, they play in sort of like, little bars. They play for either cover or a low cover or basically just the door. I mean, it's a tough life traveling in a van going from city to city to play blues.
Especially since all those people already have the music on their phone or have access to it.
Yeah, and they're not going to buy your CD, or very few will buy your CD at the gig. So you have to work harder. I mean, I know a lot of musicians in the middle tier who have dropped out of the business. They're just not going to do it anymore because they can't make a living. And that's very sad.
And this conversation has to impact the other thing you're talking about, your films, your presentation of films.
Well, my whole presentation of films is basically finding films to show and renting them for a night and showing them. That issue for me there is always, it's always tough to people to get people out of their house.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It limits that too, because I mean, why would I go to a theater and watch a movie when I can just?
It's a really good question. I've struggled with that for a couple of years now.
You've struggled with it. I've struggled with it. I think everybody's struggling with it. And then, so what's the grand answer? What do we need to do? Let's just figure this out.
In the music business,
or for films, or any of this stuff. What do we?
There's no answer. That's the sad fact. There's no answer. The internet basically is pushing a lot of things towards lower and lower prices, and so people are going to have to get accustomed to finding a niche where they can be happy to exhibit and show their wares without getting a lot of money.
Which makes it all more of a hobby than a career path.
Yeah, it's going to be a hobby and something you do, and you're going to have to really work hard to, you know, the artist on the music side, the artists who are going to do well are the artists who really know how to use the Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and Pinterest to really get their stuff across. I mean, you have to be talented not only in being a musician but being a social media expert.
So and the old joke,
and I can tell you with the people on my label, you've got some people who are really good at that and some people who aren't.
I know there's classes and people you can hire, but is that one of those things that you either have or you can see conceptually or don't have?
I think it's either you have it or you don't have it. I mean, again, I have a couple of art. I've got one artist in particular who is just a genius at social media, you know, and others who just would never know what to do. I think some of it has to do with your age. So the younger you are, the more adept you probably will be at social media. But there's also, some artists, you need that ability to actually not only do the social media, but be on the phone half the day, calling up gigs, places to play, and festivals, and selling yourself. And some people are not that good in selling themselves.
So the old joke used to be 10 years to be an overnight success. So we're looking at 15, 20, if ever?
Well, I don't know what overnight success is right now. I mean, it's, you know, the problem here is sometimes stuff will go viral. You could be an overnight success like Justin Bieber just by doing almost nothing. Something happens and you're big. It's almost like a crapshoot. You'll do all the regular things to get your music out. You don't know what will actually hit a nerve with the public and really go viral.
Yeah, I follow that with the show. I mean, it's all, at least all these new digital platforms are great because they allow us to talk and people around the world to hear us. But on the other hand, everybody and their brother can do it. So where's the what's the differentiate between my show and somebody else's show?
Exactly. That's what really makes it hard. And so it's a really tough thing. And it means, and you never know. You could do 80 shows and you find that, whoa, there's a show that really hit the public and people liked. You just never know what's going to do it.
And then you try to recreate that same magic and guess what? You don't have it.
You don't have it. It just, you know, you can't recreate viral success. Because it's viral.
So let's go back, because I didn't write this down, so correct me if I'm wrong, but you had something to do with the Pentium marketing?
I worked for Intel Corporation in the computer business, and I was a leader of a team that launched the Pentium 3 microprocessor in Asia back in the 1990s.
And now I don't know what they're up to now. It seems like every time I turn around, it's 10 times faster than the last one. I'm like, how is that even possible? Because the last one was, it just seems every time they come out, they're 10 times faster.
It's a continual cycle to get people to buy more and more faster and faster computers. And, of course, they never go fast enough. You're always still cursing at the fact that Windows is still too slow.
Well, I don't think that we could ever build a computer to make Windows work right.
Very true. So, yeah, I worked in the computer business for 9 years.
Why did I just get that blue screen?
Yeah.
Oh, no, but You're right about how it's always pushing the envelope, but I don't know. Does there come a point where we just hit the ceiling on that?
Well, when I was at Intel, one of the problems that corporations used to come to Intel and say, look, you're going too fast. We can't keep up with all the changes. We have to approve any new computer used in our company, and you're going so fast that once we approve something and deploy it, something new has already come out. So you've got to go a little slower for us to plan properly. And that was a big issue back when I was at Intel.
And even now, it's just got to be astronomical, because it seems, like I said, every time you turn around, there's somebody launching out something newer and faster. And whew.
Yep, it's...
And that, all the competition that goes... That's still... I guess we're still all talking about the same thing here, about competition and trying to be the next and be on top of it. And the more we change the topic, the more it stays the same.
Yep, that's true.
So what was the first... I must have missed somewhere about the first book. What was the first book about?
The first book was called Conservative Confidential, Inside the Fabulous Blue Tent. And it was basically a memoir about my political movement from being a left-wing socialist to becoming a conservative. And the Fabulous Blue Tent, which is in the title, was a party that I started with two other friends for gay conservatives, which we've done three times.
And do you feel that you're making a impact with that?
Well, yeah, we completely changed the Conservative Party in Canada to becoming very, very gay friendly.
Well, that's a positive outcome, because I don't follow Canadian politics, obviously, because I have my own circus to follow down here.
Yeah, so it was very, very positive, so the Conservative Party is very, very supportive now of same-sex marriage. The last Conservative government brought in several thousand gay refugees from 90 different countries. So we were, and we had a foreign minister who was gay, a Conservative foreign minister who was gay, who went around the world talking about gay rights. So that's pretty good for a Conservative government.
It's pretty good for anything, let alone government. I mean, then you add that layer on top, and it's astronomical.
Yep. So,
because they seem to be the impact. They seem to be the slowest to move.
Yeah, well, you know, look, you've got 2,000 years of anti-gay teachings from the church, 3,000 years of anti-gay teaching from Judaism, and a little less from Islam. So if conservatives are 10, 20 years later than liberals, it's nothing in the scheme of time.
So we've talked about all this. What are you doing right now? I mean...
Oh, I'm starting my next book. And my next book will be on a chat. It won't be that interesting to American listeners. I'm going to be writing on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC, which is the equivalent of NPR and PBS in the States.
I mean, you're right. Probably not broad appeal, but I'm always interested in broadcasting. What aspect of it are you holding it up and trying to?
Well, the CBC gets $1 billion a year from the Canadian government, and then when you add in their advertising revenue, they have a $2 billion a year budget. And so my book is basically about that they're just sort of disappointing given their huge budget and what they do. They don't really do a good job of telling Canada's story. They don't do a good job of telling Canadians our history. There's a lot of really good voices that never appear on the CBC. So I really want to document a view of why the CBC is actually a very disappointing organization.
Now, I just want to make sure I heard you right, because, you know, the Internet's a great thing at times, and sometimes I get little pops and stuff. They get $1 million from the government, and then...
A billion. The Canadian government. Yeah, a billion.
And then another billion in advertising, so that's two.
So they have a budget of around $2 billion a year.
And you're saying they...
I'm saying they're disappointed given the large amount of money that they have every year.
I'm just baffled by getting $2 billion and not being able to produce, like, historical stuff. You know, just that...
Yeah, well, as a good example, if you look at PBS in the States, the American Experience show,
yeah,
is terrific, okay, right? It documents all the American presidents, all the major events in American history. We do not have an equivalent in Canada. There have been no documentaries about Canadian prime ministers.
Why not? I'm just
they just haven't done them, you know? And so all the major events of Canadian history, there are no document. There are very few documentaries that are the CBC has done. I mean, they've done a few, but they've just really been absent in really telling us our story.
I can't remember the time. It probably has been a time in the last month or so. But I've been watching everything Ken Burns has done, from baseball to the Civil War to Vietnam.
I love the baseball. I love the baseball one.
Yeah, like, and not to say I catch every detail, but it's just been engulfed. That guy. Oh, boy. Either he, I'd just love to pick his brain and see how much of that stuff he actually remembers.
Good question.
That'd be so unfair, though, wouldn't it?
It would be. I'm sure he forgets quite a bit of it because he's done so much.
But then again, there's all these I think they're partially funded by PBS. I'm not 100% sure if they all are or not, but I know some of them were.
Well, if they're not funded, they're shown. I mean, he's got a home to show all his documentaries, and they're shown across the country. And they're very important documents on the American story. And
I just couldn't imagine. I never looked for them, I guess, about Canada. But I guess now you're saving me the trouble because I won't find them if I look for them.
Well, you'll find, it's not that there's none, but it's just there's nothing systematic like you have in the States. Look at the, you also have American Masters on PBS, which goes over all the major artists, musicians, movie makers in the U.S. I mean, there's Frontline, and PBS does an amazing job of covering science and current events and arts and history. And PBS gets far less money from the government than the CBC gets from Canada, the Canadian government.
Rattles my cage, which is... Well, thank you for bringing awareness to that to me, because, like I said, as a media person, so to speak, But I get so engulfed in what's going on here and trying to keep up here with all the crap, stuff.
Yep. Yeah.
You're bringing out the worst in me, Fred. I don't know. This might end badly. At least I didn't say the other word. So, looking back, now that you've gone back to Kennedy for a minute, looking back through the process of going from conspiracy to researcher to now being on the present that more of the official narrative is true than not, or all of it?
Well, I hate to use the term official narrative. I would say the evidence is very, very, very clear that there was no conspiracy and Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy. That, I think, is a better description of where we're at.
The journey throughout it all.
Yep.
Is there one takeaway besides just doing your own homework?
Well, my takeaway is that I'm glad that I had things like school and work that interfered with my JFK. I could have gone down the rat hole and become a real JFK nut, and would have gone down the rat hole and you would never have seen me again. Far too many people go down the road and never get out of this JFK stuff. And you can go really, really deeper and deeper into believing that all these crazy things. So I'm happy I just came out of it. I would have, looking back, I wish I had played guitar. For all the hours I put into the JFK assassination, I wish I had just played my guitar. I'd be a much better player right now. And so my advice to people is, go get Vincent Bugliosi's book, buy mine, read them and be happy and move on to another topic.
That is, you probably would, yeah. I think that happens to a lot of people, where they, no matter if it's JFK or any of these other things that I talk about, they get so hyper-focused on that, whatever that is, they lose track of the ball around that. life.
Oh, and you know, and I've gotten, you know, I've gotten so many, you know, nasty emails and horrible comments on Facebook and Twitter about me because my book is not a conspiracy book. I've been called names. I've been, people on the radio have said nasty things about me. It's just, it's been an incredible experience. People are so caught up and so bought into their beliefs, they get really angry when they're challenged.
See, I don't understand. I don't, again, see, here we are. I'm just going to say this again. I don't understand the rationale of bashing somebody just to bash somebody. Civil, I mean, disagreement about the topic's great, but go on and just bleep, you know, bleepity bleep bleep, you don't know crap. What's the, yeah, what's the gain?
Yeah, people have called me alt-right, which I'm not. They've, somebody on radio said that I was financed by the Koch brothers. I wish I was. I would gladly take a lot of money from the Koch brothers, but they're not offering. Somebody, one, a major JFK researcher said I owned a media empire.
Well, we got to talk later then if you own a media empire, because I
yeah, well, if I own a media, you know, if you want to buy a record company for pretty cheap, it's available. I mean, it was laughable to think that I own a media empire.
That's all.
And
some
people just say these things about me, and it's just like, wow, that's me. I never even knew that.
I can't. I just can't. Again, I mean, if you want to, you know, argue the facts or points, that's fine. But anything above that is just. Oh, from my chat room, Cat Ward, the host of Paranormal Heart, fellow Canadian, yep, says hello. So.
Oh, hello.
So we've got international listeners because I've got a few from the States, but the Canadian ones recognize. So we'll, I will do that, and I will not sing "O Canada" because, well, we do prefer to keep the listeners we do have. ugh, that'd be bad. Me singing would be bad. I'm not entertaining a record deal with you, by the way. I mean, you can offer,
okay,
but I would probably kill the rest of the music industry if we made a record. So.
You should check out one of my artists. One of my big artists is Watermelon Slim. Watermelon Slim. He's absolutely an amazing blues artist. Plays lap steel guitar. He's a Vietnam War veteran. Lives in Clarksdale, Mississippi. Used to be a former truck driver. And we just released our 7th CD with Watermelon Slim.
Got it on the notes. You know what I'm going to be doing here in about 25 minutes. Okay, so this is a music question, since you just brought it up. You mentioned steel guitar. There are some sounds that you just can't get off a computer. I mean, like, you can do a drum beat and piano and all this other stuff, but guitar, steel guitar, banjo. Am I right, or am I just being an idiot at this point?
Well, I think you're right. I don't really know enough about computer sound. It's one of those things where I assume it's going to get better and better and better and better. I don't know whether you can get the kind of sound from bending a string upward or downward on a guitar. But I don't know. You know, because computers are getting better and better and better at all this stuff.
No, just come on strong and say, no, the real performance is always going to sound better. Come on.
Yeah, you know, I'll say it, but, you know, I'm amazed because my partner's always showing me advances in drawing on computers, and it's pretty amazing whenever I see a new advance on painting and drawing on the computer. It just gets better and better and better.
I know, but I'm just saying that.
I have another friend who is a major photographer who's finally gone digital. So these technologies keep on getting better.
Finally gone digital.
Yeah,
I guess there's something to that, though, because I hate to say it, the art of actually taking a picture, because, you know, I could just take one now of myself here. I'm gonna do that while we're talking here, post it on Instagram later to prove my point. No matter, you know, I can make it look a world better with it being digital, but if you're taking it with film, you're kind of, well, I mean, I guess you could scan it and make it digital and all this other stuff, but the art of taking the photo, capturing that moment, has changed. That's probably the biggest change with technology.
Well, and the biggest change, I think, is that everybody's using their phones.
Yeah, does anybody carry a camera anymore?
No, it's all everybody's using their phones, and that's the whole camera industry, the whole photographic industry is now based on the phone.
I remember, this wasn't that long ago, I was super excited that I got 10 times zoom, I got a camera that had 10 times zoom. And my phone now has 10 times zoom.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm like, man, that was so cool the first time I pulled that thing out and zoomed in and, you know, and then I took the picture and I popped it on the computer and it was so blurry because I moved, but... but it was cool. I had to get better at it. So, between writing and music and films and... What do you do to get away from it all then?
Well, get away from it all. Well, travel, whatever. Travel a fair bit. But get away from it. I'm quite happy sitting at home and writing during the day.
You can't, I end these interviews with a little rapid fire. I was hoping you'd say travel because I wanted to ask you this question.
Yeah.
Which is, where would your dream trip be? Somewhere you haven't been already.
Well, I've spent very little time in South America and in Africa. I've been all throughout Europe. I've been all throughout Asia. So I really haven't. I'd like to go on a safari in Africa. I'd like to spend some time in a variety of South American countries.
I've never been to Europe. So if I got there, where should I go?
Oh my, there's so many good places in Europe. I mean, you should go to Prague in the Czech Republic. I mean, Prague is one of those absolutely incredible cities. The architecture is absolutely amazing. It's an incredible place. But Budapest is another great city. I mean, Paris, walking along through Paris is just fantastic. London is a really happening place right now. There's so many good places to go in Europe.
Who's your obvious? Okay, I'm gonna preference this, even though I know I don't have to. Who's your favorite author besides yourself?
My favorite author?
Yeah.
I don't know if I have a favorite author. Most of the books I read are nonfiction books. There's a variety of authors. I mean, one of my favorite authors is one of my friends out on the West Coast. Terry Glavin, who is a columnist for the National Post, who's written several really fantastic books. But I don't know if I have a favorite author because, you know, I read a whole variety of different types of books.
I obviously know your favorite genre of music, but, like, you're not going to give me one. I know that. So you mentioned Watermelon Slim earlier. Give me some more people that are on your radar, maybe not even... On your label,
In the blues world,
or anywhere in the music world, just because like we were talking, it's hard to find. I mean, the catalog's
well,
so deep.
Shamika Copeland is just one of the greatest blues vocalists out there. She's from Chicago. She's absolutely an amazing blues vocalist. So if you haven't heard Shamika Copeland, she's absolutely fantastic. There's so many great artists. I fell in love with the TV series Nashville. I loved all the music that came out of that TV series. It's great country music by a variety of artists. That was a lot of fun, that series. I don't know if you watched it at all.
No, I did not.
But good series and great music.
That's hard to pair anymore. It seems like everything's so drama, there's not necessarily good music. It's just
and
music.
What I loved about the series was that the music came first. So in any scene where there was a song being played, they made sure the song was just perfect. You know, and I really appreciated that. You know, there could be all sorts of drama going on in the series, but then they'd go to music and it would be a perfect, beautiful song. And I really appreciated that.
So, give my listeners the website one more time, because I'll make sure we get that up.
Conspiracyfreak.com. Yeah, conspiracyfreak.com. And I've got a lot of pictures there, and you could see some videos of me, and you could a whole variety of reviews and articles about my book.
Well, Fred, actually, I'm going to just let you go a little bit early because I've got a few things I need to clean up here. You probably don't want
to
listen to me.
Okay, well, thank you.
You don't want to listen to me rant, do you?
No, thank you very much. And if you ever want to have another round on the JFK assassination, I'd be quite happy.
Okay, sounds good, Fred. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye. And that's Fred Letling. Excuse me. Yeah, interesting night. I struggle with JFK a lot, and that's why I bring all these people on, from Fred to talked about it with Roger Stone, Gerald Posner, the late great Jim Mars. There have been others that we've talked about it throughout the course of the history of the show. I continue to struggle with it. Do I believe everything he said? No, I don't know. There's not a working theory in my head. Pieces of it all add up. Yeah, and speaking of which, I'll just mention this for those people out there listening. Chat room was horrible tonight, and I apologize. I don't know. They were updating, of course. Seems the people I connect with, they update their servers while I'm trying to do my show, or right before my show, so. Supposedly, you know, downtime for the rest of the world, except for me. So I'll apologize in advance for that. But, man, JFK kind of always keeps rattling around my head. Just wanted to touch base with you all. Got a few minutes left here. I didn't really take the opportunity the other night, a couple nights ago, with John Kirku. I mispronounced his name. The owner of 400 shows. Didn't really get into it with Mark a few weeks last week. Want to touch on that a little bit. A little bit more in depth. I mean, obviously, 400, Germantown Runner tells me all the time, is a big number. Of course it is. It's 100. Four. And I really struggled with that. If you listen to the end of the John Kirkulu interview, you'll hear it. You'll hear the struggle that I had with it that night. And based off that show and that moment, if you listen, like I said, go back and listen to the end of that interview, and you'll hear the struggle I had. But the struggle comes from, this is why I want to talk about this for a minute, put it in perspective for you all. It's been a ride to host the show. I was talking, Mark Anthony kind of brings this up again, because Mark, I did the first, well, from May, the end of May until the middle of August, in my bedroom closet, right? Which was literally 3 feet by 3 feet, hotter than hell in there, every week. Okay? Well, that week with Mark, I couldn't take it. I was sitting in there, I was about ready to, like, pass out before the show started. So I needed to do something different. So I have a very vivid memory of talking to Mark the first time, sitting by an open window with a folding chair, a tray table, and beside my bed in the bedroom doing the show, yelling down at my iPhone on the floor because I had Mark plugged into the mixer, right? But I didn't have a call-in number, so I wasn't doing it through the computer. I was doing it through the mixer. It was plugged, powered by a 9-volt battery, right? And just amazing to me how much the show has grown since then, to being heard in 165 countries around the world, all 50 states, been on a number of premier networks, been top 100 on Stitcher, been, yeah, okay, you get the point. I've done a lot of things. Now, having said all of that, yeah, to me, this is the same show. The website looks better, sounds better. Thanks, Brian Anderson, brianandersonvoice.com. I'm better. But honestly, it's the same show. Same notebooks, same note cards, same pens. Just grinding through it. And good nights, bad nights, horrible nights, amazing nights. I don't want to say they've all, you know, there's been highs and lows and all of that. So I have, why am I saying all this? First, I want to thank each and every one of you who listen live, who listen via podcast, who listen wherever you're listening, however you're listening. You know where you're listening. I don't have to tell you all the places you're listening. Second, I want to thank all the guests, every one of them. Good, bad, or indifferent, you made an impact on me in the show. Third, I don't want to mention all the people who have helped significantly in the course of this program, but I'll mention some that are currently impacting the show. My Chris Olson, who does my show notes, Brian Anderson, who does my audio stuff, Aaron from Verities. If you want to call in Germantown Runner, you know the number. You've only got 3.5 minutes left, though, so just be aware. Aaron from Verities, who really has been a big supporter in the last few months, not only with everything. There's just so many people that I check in with, I try to check in with constantly about how they're doing, how the show is doing. I like protecting my guests. I want to have control. I know. Some people want controversy. I want to be in control. To Dave's point about calling in during every show. He knows that. He knows how I feel about that. But there's going to be opportunities, I think, potentially down the road for both. But well, it's going to be an interesting summer. That's all I'll say about that. But to the present, it never stops amazing me how far the show has come, how far the show goes, how far... Every time I check a statistic, I think, you know, that means people are listening around the clock, around the world, every day. Now, I've said a lot of that. I've said a lot of thank yous. I'm going to continue saying a thank you right now. But, oh boy, here comes the big but. Everybody's ready, right? Everybody's ready. Here's the big but. The only thing that keeps this show absolutely moving forward is your commitment to the show. A, listening, and B, you've got to get out. I say this a lot, but you really have to be my marketing department. You have to go out and promote the show. You have to share it. You have to like it. You have to retweet it. You have to favorite it. You have to do this. I know. All of this junk. There's hundreds of shows out there that start their show and continuously bang on you doing that stuff. I'm not that show. If you've listened to the show for any period of time, I can go weeks or months without banging on you to share the show or subscribe to the show or whatever. But listen, it does need to happen. Not for me, but all these algorithms and all that crap that drives to the show so people can find it are based off all that crap. So that's how we perpetuate and keep the show growing and continue to keep these interesting guests like Fred tonight and John a few weeks ago and Mark, and I'm not going to name any more names because there's so many great names out there that I've had on the show that everybody knows.
Views and opinions expressed on the Mallard Report are those of the host and participants. For past shows, social media links, and so much more, visit Mallard.com, MALLIARD.com. And thanks for listening.
Sure. share, like, subscribe.
Science, science, science! Science, science! Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes, yes!
Woo!
Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.